So we want everyone in, so we immediately get started with SAWIC, and of course the charter, the council, and then SAWIC can begin then, or the council, whichever, because some of the questions were directed to you. So can we begin just quickly on the responses, and are we then going to have yourself, Mr. Masumbuka, on the construction sector part of council?
Madam Chair, without necessarily suggesting how to prescribe, I was wondering if perhaps you are not going to suggest that Honourable McIntosh ask his questions so they can perhaps deal with them collectively and compositely. I would prefer that.
His question was to you. It was actually going to be to the previous presenter. Am I right?
Madam Chair, no, we're not. We haven't been caucusing. but I do want to put one or two questions to him which I think could be relevant. So if you... Madam Chair, I just want to make one or two points. I think this submission from the Sector Charter Council, I believe, is one of the more important presentations we as a committee have had. I think it comes out of people who really have been closely involved with the coalface of BBEE. So I have a sense that the presentation is delivered with humility but with authority, because of the authority of knowledge. So I think it's an important presentation. I must say, I think the introduction of the Melrose, for those of you who live in the rural areas, Melrose Arch is where a lot of very rich people nowadays live. So I think the Melrose entrepreneurs is quite different from the ideas where you have a sort of, shall we say, you get some farm worker to put his name on your company letterhead, and he's a munto makaba, as they say. But this is where you've got wealthy, entrepreneurial guys who are using their black skins to get round funny racial legislation, if you want to put it that way. But that's a good thought. I think that the thought that it's not whether we have BBE or not, but how we have it. And I think that's an important point. I've got two points. The one is you have also mentioned areas of success. I think our committee seems to know where have those areas of success been, and perhaps you could spell them out, because I think it's important to know where we have made achievements. Secondly, the question, and I think this, our committee, and Madam Chair, I think those of us who may be on the working committee, in fact, this proposal is quite a different one from the one we've had before on sectors. The other one says one charter, finish and cloud, uniform, sort of commandist approach, which must be applied to everybody. Whereas this presenter, I think, is saying, look, we know our industry, we've worked at black economic empowerment, we believe that each sector has its own particular challenges and things. Please don't just abandon the sectoral element. So I think that's an important input. But thank you, Madam Chair.
Right, I think you make up the point. So if you would just again briefly answer those questions which were directed at yourself then, Mr. Masumbuka.
Thanks a lot, Madam Chair. And I think perhaps to start with Honourable Khatebe, we would gladly welcome an invitation to return, because to us, as the SAWIC members have already said, this is history in the making, and we certainly would like to participate in any process that writes or rewrites the history of our country. I normally make the joke that if we sit and don't do anything, we run the risk where I've got a three-year-old who's hyperactive. When she's 21, and when she reads in the history books, my name is going to appear. And when conditions of economic inequality are worse at that time, she's going to ask me an honest question. That, Papa, I see you were once involved in these things, but I'm still poor. What were you doing? So it's important that we need to really put together a very comprehensive commitment in this so that we really write history properly. And I also agree, I think the point you made earlier about the contradictions presented by, as SAWIC put it, the representation of black-owned 100% entities vis-à-vis an economic growth principle that is embedded in a constitutional principle of non-racialism and non-discrimination. I earlier said when I started that the problem with BEE which is, by the way, a good problem, is that it presents the trajectory of contradictions. It's a debatable space. It's a contested terrain. You will recognize, Honorable Khatebe, that, for instance, there's a debate, and Ms. Mahajwa from the DGI will confirm that normally there's been a push for local content and a push by labor for job creation. The debate currently in the construction, in the BE space is that how do you balance the interest, contradicting interests of the following? Where you have 100% black-owned company making 100 million turnover, for instance, that employs only by expert and technical expertise, vis-a-vis a white-owned company that is only a level BE level 5 contribution but employs 5,000 black people. Now that is a contradiction you cannot avoid. Now when you emphasize legislation, you must take into account those parameters, because once the one hand is black-owned, it deracializes the economy, but it employs wide-scale. You can't avoid that. And yet the other is white-owned, is not committed to change, but it gives jobs. And your jobs are your heritage as a nation. So those are the debates that Parliament and all stakeholders must consider when you deal with BEE. Now, Honorable Mabasa asked a question about how are we going to then avoid exploitation in the subcontracting space. And we faced with this quite tremendously in the construction sector, such that as part of our workflow and workstream and commitments and program, first is to do what we call subcontracting audits. We need to audit every subcontracting agreement. We may not do that 100%, but we can mitigate the risk. Because first and foremost, a subcontracting agreement is a legal agreement between two parties who, in law, are supposed to be of equal legal standing. But we know, and me and you know, that a lot of our black people go into subcontracting because they are hungry. Hence, they don't have the appetite and competence to look at the numbers. So we call it the price war. They enter into these contracts mindful of the risks, but I have to back anyway. I will take it. Half a break is better than nothing, no break at all kind of language. So what we need to do when we invoke our involvement in this contract, we must do two things. One, our approach must both be educational and regressive. Educational in the aspect that black people must avoid, when they see a deal looking good, they look left, they look right, then they sign. But when that deal comes back into their face, they run to government and all of us for help. We must create a sense of awareness and knowledge that deals, give a deal before you sign it to a second person to give you what we call the fresh eyes. And for us, to the construction sector, come to us, we have made ourselves as a construction sector, especially in my office, available to go to every meeting where a joint venture or subcontracting deal is made to input. Because we are better positioned, we are not participating in the deal, better positioned to say, these terms are not favorable for a black, small black person. You can review them and things like that. I think it goes back to what the example they did with Sandra. We must participate and actively get involved in guiding our black principals, entrepreneurs, not to involve in detrimental deals. The other question, and I think that talks to how we can then avoid the bulldozing of new entrants. Because the reality is that, and now we did make the point, established business use what is called the power of their balance sheet. They can negotiate an overdraft, they can negotiate a loan with a bank, but a black business and a small enterprise can't, because they are taken to all credit assessment, their bureau is not good because somebody used to work and he was listed. So we need to provide some form of guidance. Hence we are saying the Sector Charter Council will put in place implementing tools and mechanisms to assess the risk that small enterprises enter into these contracts, and we can then be able to assess the extent to which we are influencing change and behavior. But also, at the time, we must also be educational to our people. Black economic empowerment does not necessarily mean that every black person can suddenly be a business asset. It's not true. It is, if their view exists, it is incorrect, it must be dispelled. Some people can be business people because business takes an understanding and knowledge of the business risk associated with any business. People come to business with a 9-to-5 mentality, but the person wants to be a business person. So we must disincentivize those who do not have the heart and the thick skin to enter in business, because at the end of the day, it's also about risk. But from an empowerment point of view, we must mitigate those risks so that our people do not get into worse position than they ordinarily would have been if they didn't enter into those business deals. That is why, together with the Construction Industry Development Board, we've called what is called Contractor Development Program. That talks to exactly the issue of training and capacity. Because you can only assess progress, Honorable Mabasa, of a small black enterprise when, for instance, in terms of CFPB standard, when a person enters as a level 1 and a person progresses to a level 5, level 6, level 7, that's growth. And there was a question, Honorable Khatebe, you asked about BUSA's submission about not using the turnover as a watch call. Unfortunately, the reality of the matter is that black economic empowerment is about money. It's about economy, and economy translates into money. There's a saying that cash is king. He who holds the ATM pin holds the influence. Now, if you punish businesses, you must hit them where it matters most. That's their revenue. But as Mr. Sasha will tell you, that doesn't stop you from invoking a criminal prosecution liability for those who are fronting leverage. They must both be prosecuted criminally, but also must be fined monetarily. Because when I find monetary, it impacts back on your shareholders. There is no shareholder I know, at least, who wants to invest in a business to lose money. Shareholders invest because they want a revenue and a return. But when you hit them in their pocket, then they feel they pay. But the issue is that, and which is a debate government must have, the issue is that once we impose these fines and revenue fines, what happens to the money? Does the money relocate back to the central fiscal, or should the money be committed to a centrally focused intervention that must help those who are robbed? I think our view is that the money must be dedicated to a specific fund, so that when we tap your 100 million rand for non-compliance, we take that 100 million rand not to Prabin, perhaps to a fund that's managed by Prabin, but there must be a fund that's dedicated specifically to raise capacity of those that we have robbed by not complying. At least you create an immediate and a direct link between the punishment and the consequence. Because it goes back to a societal debate that we all have, that traffic punishment, traffic management punishment. There used to be an argument that say, why do you fine speedsters? Because if you fine speedsters 5,000 rand for driving so many kilometers with such speed, you are in effect saying, a person who has got, who is rich can budget for driving speed, because a person can say, I've got 5 million, this 5 million is gonna be right. Used just to pay speed fines, if I'm found.
Can you just respond briefly, because you've got one
yes,
minute left,
well, before
we come
madam
back
chair, so.
In writing, because we need to get started.
Thanks a lot. The last question is therefore, as I see it, is about the whole question of 51%, Madam Chair, that you have asked. In our definition, we actually call this the borderline tendencies. Borderline tendencies when companies look at which regulatory framework fits them better. In one moment, they are generic codes. Tomorrow, they are sector-specific. So they look at which certificate is convenient for them. What we are saying in the construction data is that once your business generates 51% more in anything that supplies the construction data, your cement, your bricks, then you are a construction company. You may call yourself a manufacturing company, but you are a construction company because your materials that you generate, which concentrate 51% of your revenue, comes in the sector. You must regulate it by a sector code, because you are avoiding a situation where people want double dip. One minute they want to use a generic scorecard, the other minute they want to. And I can't agree more with you, Honorable McIntosh, to say that the areas that we have agreed are successful areas must be paraded, because the tendency is that B, it does not create new entrepreneurs. B, it does not create beneficiaries. What we're saying in the charter is that where such exist, they must be recorded, they must be displayed, and they must be used as benchmarks to create and incentivize more business to come into, more black people to come into business. Thanks a lot.
I would like you to expand on what you've said in a written manner, please, through us. Thank you. And now, Sarwick.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. I will start by responding to the Honourable McIntosh's questions, and then Vuiswa, my colleague, will respond to Mr. Khadebe, and we will alternate as such until we get to the end. But we appreciate Mr. Masumbuka that he has touched on a number of questions that were common to us. So we will not repeat those. Honourable McIntosh, you acknowledge the 15 years of existence of SAWIC and you aligned that with a steady growth when you were posing your question. And the gloomy presentation, I reserved comment on that because I thought by adding steady growth, we are actually putting some light so that it's not that gloomy. In the 15 years, when we talk about the steady growth, we are referring to the fact that due to these BEE reviews and government initiatives that are in place, where we were 10 years ago and where we are at today, there is a steady growth. Growth in volume, that is the number of women in construction in particular, or number of women in business has grown significantly because the acts or the code as such has been there over the past 10 years and it has made the foundations or the ground not to be as hard as it was before. That is what we align to the steady growth. When we talk skills, compared to the previous years, the skills percentage versus what we have now and the relationship that we have with even with the construction, the heater, the authority itself, the relationship that we have, the fact that now we have, as SAWIC, engaged into a partnership to say, let us skill the women in the industry so that they are more competent, we are talking about that growth. So we can be able to measure now to say, so many engineers, that is formal qualification, but what about those who have registered their companies with CIDB, but they were doing catering? So we are saying, we screen you, we have got skills development with the construction sector. So we align our growth to that. And then the second question was on the membership. How inclusive are we when it comes to other races? We are catering for those. However, the percentages are such that 60% of our membership are black, African, and then we've got the 40% that makes the other races. We've got white women as well, honorable member. However, the emphasis of today was on black women-owned enterprises. That is why we did not make the mention of as such. Coming to the third question, which was around the Eastern Cape incident of SANRAL and the big companies or the captains of the industry, when we approached SANRAL and these big companies, we were looking for 30%, which is stipulated in the tender document that of the 10 billion that you have, 3 billion must go to black women empowered entities. So we were there to ask for where is the 3 billion for the black women owned enterprises. Hence we saw it as an insult for people to make reference to the TCOs and the flagmen, etc., because that was just not telling at all. So we were looking for significant participation in this to ensure that we emancipate our women in the economy as we wish. I think that was about all from Mr. McIntosh. If there is any that I've left, I think my colleague next to me will add on to that as well. So over to you, Vuyiswa, for Mr. Khadebe.
Okay, thank you. Honorable Shay, I'll respond to the questions by Honorable Khadebe and Mabasa and Wabama. The first question that I will respond to was, it was a question and comment, I think, whereby he said in our presentation he didn't hear much about the disability, because as women, especially women of this country, as we have presented ourselves as well, that we are the majority, we are the breadwinners, we are the heads of the family, we should actually try to accommodate as membership. We do have a membership of SAWIC of women who are having disabilities, and as such, I'm very proud to say that I think with the construction sector, that is our stakeholder at this point in time, we've got an MOU with them in terms of learnership that we're going to pull through of about a very big sum amount that we've been granted on their discretionary grant. We've set about 10% targets of having the women, young women, leadership and apprenticeship program, and 10% for disabilities. specifically we are busy with the screening process right now, just to ensure that we've got young women, 10% of the number that we're going to be taking, we need people who've got disabilities. So we are actually focusing on it as well. We've got youth, we've got disabilities, and we've got our own women as well. So we do encompass those three spheres of the advantage groups. And in terms of how do we make sure that we are actually not sidelined on businesses in terms of procurement process? I think there was a comment there that came from. You will know that we've got a regulatory board in the construction industry, which is the IDB. This triple equal bill now, it actually works. I think sometimes it works differently in certain sectors as well, because we've got the IDB that's supposed to be a regulatory board, which is, it does to a certain extent those things. But what happened is that this response I will give to also answer my colleague's one, because and Honourable McIntosh's question, because when you are an engineer, you've got an experience, you've worked for 9 years or 10 years in a big company or as a project manager. But the minute you start to do your own construction business, you start at grade one. So the frustration that are surrounded there is that you're going to be frustrated to managing a turnover project that is your company's project now of about 50,000, whereas you are coming from managing a project of about 5 billion or 500 million. And the stagnation that happens within that process, which is actually, it's got lots of influences. First of all, you have to prove that you're turning over with your company before you get to the next grade level. Yeah. So those are the things that actually, you know, they're sort of preventing people to grow a little bit there. And the procurement process themselves, because whether you can say that I'm Vuiswa, I've got a built environment degree or diploma, but now because I'm sitting a company now, in construction company, I'm going to start there at a grade one level. So my experience with whatever I was doing has nothing to do with now my company doesn't have a takeover to show for that. So those are the things that we, while we're dealing with this, we're also dealing with them at the construction regulatory board. In terms of how do, Honourable Kwabaza asked about how does the distinction being made between the new and the old guys in the industry. I can tell you that's the worst frustration that we've got. On the 5th of December, we're busy with the framework amendments of the CIDP. You will recall that there were stadiums that were built that actually is called the worst havoc in the country, because the collusion came from those stadiums. And when the stadiums were finished, we couldn't enter into that space because of the level we were, you know, as small businesses. So it was only the big players were there. But when all those projects, you know, were done, they do what we call in construction industry, they do it downgrading, they go down. They do the small projects, you go to the same tenders as the big guys of the same level of grade, because there's nothing that stops them that if you're grade 9, you cannot do your grade 3 work. You know, if you are greedy, there is something that stops you to do great time work because your balance sheet doesn't show, you know. So those are the things that actually frustrate the new entrants, because you are not only competing amongst yourself as a new entrant of the year, you are also competing about the people who have long been in the industry as well. So those are the things that really frustrate the people who are actually entering the industry, and the people who are also actually still very lower grades in the industry. So at this point in time, there isn't anything that actually prevents it to stop that unhealthy competition. You have advised as well, also commented, Honourable Robert, in terms of maybe as some, we also need to do our own training. How do we in fact do our own to ensure that we do not have people who, you know, also do some shared works and also ensure equal amongst ourselves? That's what we do. We've got a rigorous process of skills audit that we do amongst our members. And that skills audit determines exactly who does what and who qualifies what, who's got what expertise. And that skills audit is also that we use when we're actually being invited, you know, by some big captains of industry when they've got their enterprise development programs. And they will say, for instance, we are looking for tech companies that are at this grade level in order to develop them. But again, that process gets manipulated again by the captains of industries, because you would give those companies as a week, 10 companies to, I don't want to mention this begins. When you give those companies there, you find that their training is so suppressed, and then that they just must remain as subcontractors, nothing else. We normally call that, I don't know, maybe it's a fear. I always say, I wonder if it's a result of a fear of developing a small cup to become a lawyer, that whereby that lawyer will be able to compete with you in 3 or 4 or 5 years' time. But the enterprise programs at this point in time is being manipulated in a very serious manner in two folds. It's either if the program happens, those people will be developed just to be subcontractors, nothing else, they won't go beyond that. Or else, the enterprise program, the big guys, if they have to submit anything to say that, show us enterprise development program, if they've got lots of subsidiary companies, they will take some of the subsidiary companies and show them of their enterprise development program. So that process, again, it sits with really a rigorous process that has to be seen, or someone who has to actually be a watchdog over it. So it's really difficult in terms of that growth. So the last one was the... Oh, I really wanted to mention, I thought my colleague next to me was going to mention, we are seriously affected in the industry. We've been directly affected by the collusion that has happened in the industry. It's been very quiet. We know that there are investigations that are happening. We also know that there are people who have confessed. And we are saying, in the meantime, because we were very aggressive on the approach, we even thought that maybe the minister, it's public works, should actually just try to deregister these guys up until, you know, there's a clear, you know, of a direction in terms of what is going to happen. We know that there are serious threats as well in terms of if they're getting deregistered, this guy, they are actually looking at 80% of unemployment in the country. Some of them are in the JSE or the stock exchange might be shaken up and all those things. And in the meantime, we are saying maybe this is an opportunity for government and some people who are not involved there, you know, who are having at least ethics, to try to accelerate the development of these small businesses in the construction industry. I hope I have covered most of the questions that are and the comments that were there, but yeah, that is it from my side. Thank you.
If you can allow me to, I think we just need to close off now, and I'll tell you why we are running a bit late. We do need to take CASA and Vodacom now at this time, 1:45. But what I would do appreciate is your presence here throughout the process today, and we hope you'll take the opportunity of staying on for as long as you can. Can we please ask CASA to please come forward? But thank you very much, and I know that the Secretary will be writing to you just with one or two areas that we'd like further clarification on in writing and give you the time, perhaps a week or so, to come back, and I know the subcommittee are looking forward to that. Thank you. I was talking to allow you to come forward, CASA. Thank you. Right, we've got before us quite a few people, but it's on the broad-based Black Economic Empowerment Bill, Chief Executive Officer of the Casino Association of South Africa, Themba Ngubesi. Is that correct? And then we also have your colleague. And your colleague here is Mr. Charles Fauri. Is that correct? General Manager. Thank you. And thank you for your patience as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was actually approaching the podium, but unfortunately we needed the seats, so that's why we sat down again. Good morning to you, Honourable Madam Chair, and Honourable members of the committee, ladies and gentlemen. We appreciate the opportunity to come before the committee today to address you on this important piece of legislation. Chair, having looked through the bill, we certainly intend to cover only two aspects which are very critical to the casino industry. The assumption is that the committee would have been provided with our submission where we detail these two concerns, and the idea today is to go through them with the committee. But first, I think we should actually say who are we in brief. CASA is a voluntary association with the presence of licensed casinos in South Africa.
We've had RC here 5 times, so we're well aware who you are. You were here for the Gambling Act. legislation. If you can move on to the bill.
To the bill. Thank you. So I think the important and critical aspect to point out is that our members have been in the empowerment space since inception. There was an empowerment framework that we had before we had BBB legislation in 2003. When our members applied for casino licenses as way back as 94 and 95, they already had to make commitments relating to BBB to BEE at the time. Obviously, the shortfall at the time was that it was only restricted to ownership and procurement. So it's different in that sense, but the commitment and the understanding of the need for empowerment was already there. So we kind of preceded the BBB legislation in our industry at least. And so as recently as 2009, we made a commitment publicly that the industry will be level 2 by 2010, which we delivered on, and an audit and verification conducted by Empowerdex confirmed this rating, which we did achieve by 2010. Now, the concern is that obviously we're concerned that if we do have the changes as proposed in the course, that rating will go away. So I must hasten to point out that the worry for us is not that the codes are changing. It's what is associated with the codes, and I'll come back to and explain exactly why it becomes a concern for us. And so the issue is not so much about that the codes are changing, but it's the impact that it has on us in terms of our casino licenses. So in broad terms, we support the objectives of the amendment bill, and in particular, we welcome the alignment of the Act with other legislation that impacts on BBB and the codes of good practice. But as I said, having said this, we're concerned about two very specific sections which can be read together, but I'll deal with them in turn. First one is section 9.6, subsection 9.6. Now, the first bullet point is that in this proposal, the minister may then grant public entities the permission to specify qualification criteria that is over and above the codes. Now, I wish to pause and point out that, in fact, unfortunately in our space, the gambling regulators did not have to wait for this proposed 9.6. They've already given themselves the power to impose conditions, criteria that is over and above the codes. And we'll go into detail with it. So they didn't have to wait with it. But if one considers what it will do to our industry, it simply means that we are regulated by 10 gambling regulators, one for each province and one national regulator. So we have 10. So we do sit with the possibility that we might end up with 10 different qualification criteria on BBBEE that we have to comply with as an industry, and that becomes problematic because one, it obviously goes against what the bill is trying to achieve, which is alignment in terms of national policy, and second, it makes it very difficult for us to comply because unfortunately the requirements sometimes as they're imposed from one province to the next do not work together. Sometimes they're contradictory to each other, which results in us not being able to score the BBB points that we should. And that is a concern. That is, if Section 9.6 goes through, we've seen in practice, and then I'll come to it in terms of Section 10, we may just end up with 10 different criteria on the very same thing about BBB, which is national policy, and it puts us in a very difficult position. In practice, this is what had happened, and I'll refer back to the point I made about subsection 6. The gambling regulators that I've just mentioned, being the 9 provincial gambling regulators, they're called in legal terms provincial licensing authorities, and the National Gambling Board, have deemed it fit to interpret section 10 in such a manner that they regard it as giving them powers to impose any condition on BBB over and above the course. They have went to an extent of prescribing and placing it in our casino license conditions that we will be level 2 by 2015. Now, that is not so much of a problem. The problem is that should anything happen that you don't meet level 2 by 2015, it means that you lose your casino license, and that becomes the critical aspect. The ultimate price is that you may lose that license, and that becomes now a very serious matter. So it's not so long about participating in BBBE, embracing it, and contributing, and actively contributing to it. Then it means that you now lose a license, and you may just start from the casino. And that's where it becomes very critical for us. And some of the things are beyond our control. And in fact, our fears, which we've been expressing to the regulators, have now materialized. Because having now achieved level 2 by 2010, the codes are about to change. And even though we have not had the full impact, because we've not even seen the final version, but the version of the codes that is out there, the draft codes, will guarantee us that we will not be able to meet level 2 by 2015, meaning that our casino license is at risk. But that's a big concern. And the reason why I'm mentioning that is that I'm saying sometimes the conditions that make you achieve particular points are beyond your control. One of them was codes changing, like they have changed. Secondly, some of the members are public listed entities. Unfortunately, the shareholding in listed entities changes every minute. And it's very difficult to control because it's traded on the Joint Stock Exchange. And if for some reason you drop a point on ownership, which just make you to be in level 2, you may be a level 3 and receive your casino license for 2015. So it is a serious concern for us because our regulators have simply just went ahead and imposed these conditions, which places that there's a serious risk. We've always understood that we have to play in the BBB space, that we have to comply, but it was always going to benefit those that comply, because they'll have a good score and they'll contribute to the society, and those that don't will suffer the consequences. But in this case, the consequences are dire because it means that we may have to start down operations, which is a serious matter. This thing goes further. Again, reading Section 96 to Section 10 now, is that our regulators have not only done the casino licensing, they have also imposed other conditions. So we are required, these are commitments we made before the 2003 Act, we are required to set aside certain procurement spend for local PDI-owned companies. But local, in this case, we're not talking South Africa versus any other foreign country. We're talking Limpopo, for example. If you operate in Limpopo, that government has said, in Limpopo, you will buy 30% from PDI-owned companies. And that PDI-owned is very restricted because it talks to the pre-2003. It talks about the shareholding. And to add to that, we will then have conditions that say you must procure an X percentage of your spend. X amount must be from local companies, meaning Limpopo, or from PDIs. And PDI is not the same as what you have in the codes. So trying to juggle the three balls and still end up with a score that needs you to comply with the BBB Act becomes a very real problem. Now, if Section 96 goes through as it is, but it simply means that it will simply just confirm the view of what the regulators have taken on Section 10, and they will continue doing what they are doing in terms of imposing conditions that are entirely just over and above the codes, and we risk losing our casino licenses, which is where our concern is. But more importantly, I think the way that the Section 10 has been interpreted by regulators now definitely does not promote alignment in terms of this very important policy of BBBEE. It fragments it. It depends from one province to the next, and some of the requirements do not work well together. You cannot be able to achieve both at the same time. Now, moving on to subsection 10, 2 and 3. Now, the difficulty that we have again relates to uniformity. And we're slightly unique in the sense that we operate both casinos and we also in the tourist sector. So we operate hotels, restaurants, conference facilities, etc. So we operate in both space. Now, the impact of subsection 2 and 3 is that it says if there's a code, and there is a sector code for tourism, and we operate in both space, and it says if there's a code, you must be rated using the sector code. Now, if that happens, it means that we have a problem, because the gambling regulator expects us to be related on the generic scorecard. And on one hand, we must then comply with the sector code and can't find the alignment unless the bill makes that clear and specifies that position. We have two masters to serve, and we unfortunately can't be both satisfied from the same operation. And it gets worse, of course, if you still also have to do procurement as a specific procurement from PDIO companies in a province, and acquire a certain percentage from local provincial suppliers. So I think it will be very important, I think, that committee actually does clarify this issue and we find a solution on which code should we comply with, because the regulators expect us to comply with the generic scorecard. And if section 2 and 3, subsection 10, 2 and 3 goes through, we'll be expected to comply with the sector code. And unfortunately, these two are just contradictory. But more importantly, I think it goes back to the thread, one of the main objectives of the bill, which is this alignment. It's definitely not helped by the current practice in the gambling industry from the regulator side. And then in conclusion, I think, as I indicated, that we're very concerned about subsection 9.6 and read together with subsection 10 in brackets 2 and in brackets 3. And we submit that if this situation is not corrected and these amendments do go through, the difficulties that we face are not going to go away. And it actually undermines our ability to continue to participate and be an active participant in the DDD space in a meaningful manner. And for the reasons stated above, we actually advocate for the withdrawal of these subsections from bill, alternatively an exemption of sort to enable us to be meaningful participants in the DDD space. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very, very much. So your colleague, anything to add? Right. So, Mr. Ngabesi, I really appreciate the PowerPoint that you've given us, which has clearly outlined everything. Thank you very much. And our long association with CASA has, you know, is able to contextualize this within that background. Thank you very much indeed. Honourable Salah, Honourable Khadebi, Honourable McIntosh, in that order.
Thanks, Chairperson. You have already thanked the presenter for the presentation. I will not repeat that. Just going straight to the question that I have is, CASA, what do you say is the actual problem in supporting the BEEs in the local or relatively PDIs, even if it may not be in the local? I don't really get what the problem is, unless you make reference to specific problems such as the availability of the things you want to buy, such as casino machines. For instance, they may not be there in the PDIs, they may not be there in the local area. But other than that kind of, what is the problem? What is the problem in going to buy your raw material for making food from the local farmers or from the PDIs? What is the problem in buying the things you use there? Companies that are cleaning in the casinos and all these other things that are available within the local market or within the PDIs. Well, what's your difficulty in getting it from there? How does it make it a problem?
Honourable Khadebe.
Thank you, Comrade Chairperson. I think this question will go directly to TTI. Because this presentation has got serious consequences, out of withdrawal of state and proposal to withdraw certain sections of this bill. Yeah. And then I think that is a dilemma in which they are, whereby a company will be operating in two different sectors, which has got two different charters. I think, did the department not anticipate that a problem? And then how does we address it going forward? Because it is true. And then when you go to the issue of the change ownership at the HSE, that one is also a factor. How is the department going to ensure that we counteract that? the, because the issue of ownership is critical in the sense of the courts. But this fluidity of the ownership in the public listed companies, how do we intend to deal with that one? But on the other aspect, I want to ask the presenter whether is it in support of what Black Business Council, SAWIC, has said that the Broad-Based Bank Economic Empowerment Act must be the one which supersedes everything, even considering the charter. What is their attitude towards that? Thank you, Jim.
Thank you very much. And then the Honourable McIntosh.
Madam Chair, as you said, we do know CASA well, and of course, Mr. Tawaz is not here, but he was the chairman of our little working committee, so he has good insight. But thank you. I think it's a very clear presentation. It helps us to concentrate our minds on the difficulties, and it's easy to have policies, sometimes the unintended consequences. I must say you put out a few. Just one question, Ms. Ngorese, on that Section 9C6. 9.6, you said, which is the one which says, if requested to do so, minister may by notice in the Gazette permit organs of state or public entities to specify qualifications, criteria for the term, which exceed those set by the minister. Now, would you be comfortable if it were to be, and look, I don't want to see into every detail of the bill, that there's a working committee which will deal with that, but if one were to say that he could, other economics, which exceed or are less than those set by the minister. In other words, one introduces the principle of flexibility. So in other words, they can go down as well as up. Would, and obviously I know it's a bit off the cuff and you're probably not a lawyer, but maybe you could just give us an opinion on that.
Thank you very much. Are there any other comments in this regard? Yes, I am concerned with the 9.6 per se, because you do speak about the challenge of the different, you know, possibility of different sets of requirements coming up in the different provinces. And clearly, you know, we need to grapple with that one, and I'm glad one of the questions was directed specifically at DTI. And I say this to preface every response. If you haven't got the information here, don't waste our time speculating. Respond to what you can, and the rest comes back in writing.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize for introducing CASA for the 10th time, but sometimes it's very dangerous to assume. Chair, I do have the answers to the comments that have been made. On the first issue, Honourable Silau was asking what is the problem with doing local. It is usually not a problem. It was not a problem at all until we had the 2003 Triple B Act. The issue is simply that it's two different requirements and they contradict each other. It's two different standards. You know, the conditions that we placed, for example, to buy 15% of say your procurement spend, that we allocate 50% to local black-owned, PDY black-owned companies, was before this act, and it simply just meant PDIs at the time, and it was not what it is now, and the definition of that was definitely not what you find now in the new Act, in the 2003 Act. It's what existed before then. For example, the way it used to be calculated, if to maybe to practicalize, is that in the past we would buy milk from a company that is 70% owned and 30% owned maybe by a white partner. Will allocate only 70% to the triple B spend and do those calculations. And that is goes to the root of our license conditions. So we must comply with that because we want to keep our license, but then we must also comply with the triple B Act as it currently exists now as a totally different format. Now you have seven elements with very specific requirements that you have to do. So, and sometimes they're toothless. It's usually not possible to be able to satisfy both the regime before the 2003 Act and the regime after the 2003 Act. I don't know if that satisfies the member.
specific? Are you referring to the bill which is before us, which is not an act, or are you referring to the act which is not BBBEE per se, amendment bill? Are you referring to the current act?
The current act. The current
act. Currently you've got a problem.
What I'm saying is that there was a regime that existed before the 2008 Act, because we got our licenses and started operating before 2003, and then there was a new regime with the 2003 Act, and the requirements, the definitions are not the same, requirements are not the same, and usually it's difficult to try and, it's almost like you must do two spreadsheets and come up with two totally different results. And we would not mind to continue reporting with the pre-2003 Act, but the problem is that then when we now have to produce our certificate in terms of the general scorecard is different. And the irony of it is that it is the same regulator that asks you to do both these things. So they still expect you to give them level 2 by 2015, sorry, and they also expect you to still do what you promised to do in 1994. And then on the second question is, on the top, the question was asked by Honorable Beke Khatebe, what is our view on whether the BBBEE Act should be the trumping act? Absolutely. I think as an industry, all we really need is a set of piece of legislation on this important national policy that we can comply with and not having to serve three different masters at the same time. As it exists now, we'll end up with three masters because it will be the provincial gaming regulator in terms of what we call deliverables. So this is like pre-2003, and then we must then satisfy them on the BBBEE 2003, and then we must not satisfy the Tourism Sector Council if this amendment goes through. And the three masters, sometimes we will not be able to make them happy, all of them at the same time. So we certainly support that the BBBEE should be the legislation in the BBBEE space. Honorable McIntosh, on the flexibility, I think it's obviously something that needs a lot of thought, but the difficulty is that as soon as you have, and I think we appreciate that in some industries it becomes important to make adjustments, but the problem is that as soon as you have more than one public entity that does the same thing for the same industry, it becomes a problem. Maybe for industries that are regulated maybe by just one public entity, that's very easy because they issue one, everyone complies with that. In our case, unfortunately, as I said, we may then end up with 10 different qualification criteria set by different provinces, and if our members operate nationally, you know, so if maybe they operate in only one province, it would be easy because they just have to worry about that. But imagine if you have an operation with 14 casinos all over the country and then you have to worry about the requirements in Limpopo versus Gauteng, and you happen to be the compliance manager of this big animal, it becomes very, very difficult. But more critically, it actually does not promote alignment and meaningful empowerment in the process, because then you end up, it's almost like all you're doing is trying to satisfy the parties that are expecting you to give them the raising cards. Chair, I think I've covered all the comments.
Oh, thank you, that's great. Look, BGI, you were called upon. Are you able to respond now, or will you do so in writing and come back later, perhaps on Tuesday or another day?
Yes, sir. We will request that we provide it in writing, because the one question that we need to consult with the BGI. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Because I think it's quite important. I mean, the only speculating that we would want to entertain with CASA is that connected with gambling, you know, when you're actually at the casino and not with the legislation per se. So clearly that one we will verify and make sure there's consistency and alignment in all areas. Okay, but let's not press now, because we're not going to get, you know, a realistic comment or response. So I want to thank you very much for being here. I also want to thank you for your patience. And as I said, you've become old friends, Carter, with 4 years of engagement. Thank you. On various.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much. We do appreciate it, and your patience in particular. Thank you. Can we ask Vodacom
To come forward, we have Mr. Matthew Kirk, Director of Vodacom Group External Affairs, Mr. Nkateko Nyoka, Chief Officer, Legal and Regulatory Affairs, Vodacom Group, and Ms. Linda Martinez, Executive Head, BBBE, and the Transformation Vodacom Group, Mrs. Impor, or Ms. Impor Mkavuka, Manager of Parliament and Government Relations. So it sent quite a large team here today, and we certainly would appreciate it if you can go straight into the issues. As I said, we would appreciate it. Thank you so much. I don't know who will be leading us.
Chairperson, thank you very much for the opportunity for Vodacom to express its views on the BBBE Amendment B. And by way of introduction, Chairperson, essentially want to make the point that we will be speaking to two fundamental issues, one being the BBBE Act, in our view, as an overarching policy framework for regulating BEE, and the second issue would be the BEE Commission. And just to set the scene, I thought I should ask Mr. Matthew Kirk, who essentially comes from Vodafone. As you would know, Vodafone holds about 65% of shares in the Vodacom Group, and Mr. Matthew Kirk will be presenting a perspective to Parliament from Vodafone as an investor of more than 15 years in the South African telecommunications market. And Mr. Kirk, before joining Vodafone, by the way, he worked with the British Prime Minister, Mrs. Margaret Thatcher. He's also worked in the office of British Prime Minister Tony Blair. So thank you. I shall allow you, Matthew, to set the scene.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and honourable members. It's a great honour to me to be in the position to address this important committee of the South African Parliament on this very important issue. As Mr. Nyoka has already said, Vodafone has been an investor in South Africa for a number of years now. We were part of the original group of shareholders who founded the Vodacom Group in 1994, and in 2009, as Mr. Nyoka has said, we moved our shareholding up to 65% and became the controlling shareholder of Vodacom. Vodacom remains a South African company listed on Johannesburg Stock Exchange with a South African board and predominantly South African management. And that was very much part of the commitment that we gave at the time to our interest in the future of Vodacom. We see ourselves as a long-term investor in South Africa, a long-term commitment to South Africa, and a commitment to investing more widely in Africa through our interests in Vodacom here in South Africa. A very quick word on our perception of broad-based back economic empowerment, looking at it as a foreign investor from the UK. First of all, to say that we completely understand the rationale behind the broad-based back economic empowerment system that you have put in place here in South Africa. And as such, as an investor in a major South African company, we have been pleased to be in a position to support it in a number of ways, starting back in 1997 with HDI investment scheme, which involved obviously our shareholder support, but also quite significant financial support. Moving through to the current Vodacom broad-based back economic empowerment scheme, which is the fifth largest BEE equity deal in South Africa, concluded in 2008, again with our strong support both as a shareholder and financially. So I hope that our track record is one that shows not only our understanding but our willingness to take positive actions in support of BBBE. However, I would say, and I think this is the importance, and Mr. Nyaga will talk in a moment about the details of our submission, we have found this process to be one looked at from outside South Africa's borders that is quite hard to plan into an investment cycle. What makes it hard is the uncertainty that currently exists within the broad-based economic empowerment regime as it applies to the telecom sector. And the reason for this essentially is that we have had three instruments in front of us. We've had the generic codes and the main BBBE legislation. We've had a draft ICT sector code, which was in draft for many years and finally gazetted last year, which was a very important step forward. But we also have a completely separate set of provisions in the Electronic Communications Act, which governs the role of our sector regulator. And in a way, echoing some of the points just made by the representatives of CASA, if you are trying to manage a major investment and manage a major financial interest, it's very hard if you don't have a single clear set of requirements in front of you and a single authority with which to deal in order to understand how to satisfy those requirements. So we would very much like to see this process of amendment of the BBBE legislation to be one which results in greater certainty for us as an investor, which will allow us to move forward confidently with our investments in South Africa, respecting the BBBE principles. Mr. Nyaga.
And then, I'm taking over from Matthew Tack, essentially wants to make the point that fundamentally the purpose of the BBB Act Amendment Bill, as articulated in the draft bill, is essentially to strengthen compliance, but more importantly, to ensure that the BBB Act is established as a primary legislation for regulating BEE. However, a number of concerns arise, as has been articulated by the previous speaker from CASA, with respect to Section 9.6 and Section 10.2. I think the two provisions are in conflict with one another, in the sense that 9.6 essentially gives authority to public entities to set higher the targets if approved by the Minister of Trade and Industry. Now, if you're speaking to our sector specifically, which is telecommunications, that authority is essentially bestowed to the Independent Communications Authority of South Africa. And I need to point out that the BEE has been with this sector since the liberalization of telecommunications, and to a great degree at some point was regulated via conditions that were imposed in our license conditions. And then over time it was regularized via the introduction of some of the provisions into legislation, such as the Electronic Communications Act, which has a provision that essentially requires no less than 8% in equity. In parallel, you have the Independent Capital Act, essentially, which basically gives you CASA the authority to come up with regulations to regulate BEE. Now, what has tended to play out in our sector is that on the one hand, you have the BBB Act that professes to be the overarching legislation regulating BEE. You then have the Electronic Communications Act that sets a different set of standards. Now, at a practical level, what happened is about 5 years ago, Vodacom did one of the largest BEE deals in the country, but it was done on the basis of an understanding that at some point the BEE as well as the ICT sector code were essentially going to override the provisions of the Electronic Communications Act and the CASA Act. That never materialized for a very long period of time. And the result was that there was so much uncertainty as to whether, you know, our deal of 2009-2008 will hold or not hold. At practical level, this is what it meant. ECASA was about to award spectrum. And in awarding spectrum, they were having difficulty about coming up with the best criteria. Now, internationally, you would have said, you want to allocate spectrum that is in high demand, you probably go the route of auction. The attitude of ECASA was that going the route of auction is not going to benefit your small BE or medium-sized enterprises because they don't have the resources too big for spectrum. They therefore invoke the provision in the ECA that essentially says the threshold should be 30% equity. What would have been the consequence? The consequence would have been your main telecoms companies in South Africa, i.e. Vodacom, Telkom, Cell C, and MTN wouldn't have qualified for spectrum. From a perspective of economic development, what would that have meant? It would have meant that in an environment like South Africa, which has to drive internet access via wireless technology, and if you're doing it via wireless, if you're trying to achieve internet access via wireless technology, spectrum become a very essential ingredient of that process. It would have meant Vodacom, MTN, who have the wherewithal to deploy networks, would have been excluded from that process. Now, just talking about spectrum, I just wanted to make the point. Internet access, we're talking about broadband access, which lately has become a primary policy for the government of South Africa. But some of the statistics coming from the World Bank point to if you manage to drive 10% penetration by way of internet or broadband access, the corresponding contribution to the GDP of the country is anything between an additional amount of 1% and 1.6%. If it's via voice penetration, the contribution to GDP is about 0.6%. Now, what that meant is a valuable, scarce national resource like spectrum, making a decision on the basis of an arbitrary B measure set up in a piece of legislation called the Electronic Communications Act, which is not aligned to the requirement of the broad-based or triple B Act. It would have meant to exclude your main players who can drive economic growth, who can contribute meaningfully to job creation, simply because you've got the pressure that you must try and open up the market by allocating spectrum or via the allocation of spectrum to your emerging telecommunications companies or BE companies. And that is not to say that BE is important, but what we're trying to point out is there is serious consequences to any decision that you make to BE with respect to contribution that the telecommunications sector can make to our economy. And fundamentally, we basically believe that the confusion originates from the fact that there isn't an acknowledgement from a policy perspective that there ought to be one regulatory instrument in South Africa for managing BE. And in our submission, Madam Chair, we make it clear that the responsibility for managing BEE, for regulating BEE, should lie with the Triple BEE Act. And to the extent that there may be conflict between the Triple BEE Act and any other legislation that seeks to regulate BEE, the Triple BEE Act should reign supreme. In other words, it should trump any other law. Now, Madam Chair, I'm sensitive to concerns about time, and I think I've made all my points around our concerns with the conflict between Section 9(6) and 10(2) of the current draft of the Triple B Act. And if you allow me, Madam Chair, I want to move to next concern, which is the Triple B Commission. Now, I think speaking to the Triple B Commission, I essentially want to make the point that South Africa has a number of commissions, institutions, that are appointed with a specific purpose of regulating a particular specialized sector of the economy. In this instance, we're talking about BEE. But I want to submit to this committee that it's equally a truism that many of these commissions come with their own challenges. And I can point to a committee which probably emanates from a piece of legislation which was passed by this committee, National Consumer Commission. And I think the ideas around protecting the interests of consumers are laudable, and we should all support that. And as a company, I think we've put in place a number of systems to ensure that we address the concerns of consumers. But what happened, there was a committee established independent of the Department of Trade and Industry. Historically, the management of those functions resided within the Minister of Trade and Industry. As soon as it was hived off, or those activities were hived off, and a specialized or supposed independent commission was created with so many problems, and the end result is that the institution was discredited. Now, we want to submit, Chairperson, that the regulation of BEE is important. In our view, it has to reside with the Ministry of Trade and Industry. To the extent that they may be concerned with resources, we think the resources around regulating BEE would be better utilized if the division within the DTI that manages BEE issues is well resolved. But in the event that Parliament feels very strongly that an independent body needs to be created, it is a submission that creating such a body, we probably need to follow different type of mechanisms. Some of them are articulated in Chapter 9 of the Constitution. So it probably created as an independent body that reports directly to Parliament, and it doesn't report into a line function ministry. But our strong recommendation is it's utilize the current resources at the DTI. Don't duplicate that function by getting someone else to do that function, because in so doing, you know, you'll need to resource the institution, set aside a budget for it. And in a country where we're stretched in terms of resources, at least for the moment, we don't believe that it's a good idea to set up a BEE commission outside of the Department of Trade and Industry. So that is really our input, Chairperson. And on that note, I want to thank you very much and to let you know that we are available to take questions if there are any. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much indeed. Do appreciate that. For my understanding is that the BEE Commission, well, it will have an independence, as it were, perhaps autonomy may be the right word, unlike possibly Competition Commission, what was previously the Consumer Commission. It will in fact reside and be within, as it were, the greater framework of DTI itself, and not, not too sure if it's independent or what it is. Yeah, okay. Honourable Khadebe, Honourable McIntosh, Honourable Mabasa.
Chairperson, thanks for this good input you said before us. I think it's enlightening. It makes our job to be very easy. So my question again will still go to the department, to the CTI, whether they consulted the Department of Communication or ICASA itself as an authority which deals with that. So I think that they might not respond now, but if they didn't do that, I think that is very urgent, because these issues which are being raised here, it's very difficult to serve two continents. It has never worked. You still serve one well and then ignore the other one. So I think that if we can get that from the side of the DTI, so that when we deal with the pay clause by clause, we must be sure what is the stand of the Department of Communication, what is the stand of the ICASA itself. Because as an authority, ICASA was the authority when coming to communication or ICT sector. So I think that that aspect must be done with. We really appreciate that you highlight those conflicts, so early in the end. But I think that as we move forward again, we might need you to come back again to come with a better type of perspective, which is a better scenario, which might fit you. Because at the end of the day, we are going to create a law which must be able to be implemented by the people on the ground. That's the critical aspect. We cannot come with a law which is going to be unimplementable. So number two, the person is also, I can see that there's also now a new proposal together, do away with the DE commission, do then deal with the directorate. But I would have preferred the situation by when you have a special DE commission, it's a necessary thing to have because of the challenges we had in the past. Once you deal with the directorate within a department, its focus is scattered all over together because there are many challenges, so it's going to be scattered. So we need a body of people who will be focused on this issue because the issue of PE must no longer be the sideshow. It must be the issue, the primary act in the economy of South Africa. Because if we want to advance it really, as I said before, the National Development Plan of the Republic demands that South Africa must be a different place by 2030. Part of the PE commission, I think we can do better. I think that I'll really appreciate the situation if Vodacom can push towards empowering us. How can we make this commission to function better than the others? We really acknowledge the consumer community had a lot of challenges. But from those challenges, those things must be stepping stones for us so that we do better legislation and come with better regulations as we move forward. And then the last but not the least, really, as a country, we'll always appreciate the foreign direct investment in this country. We don't want policy uncertainty, whatever it may be. I think that it is in the interest of the country that we get more cash flow coming to the country so that we can create new enterprises, so that we can grow our economy, because it's only through the growing the economy that we can have better sharing in the long run. But I think this deal is part of doing that. I also really appreciate the aspect that the PE must be an overarching act so that whoever, whatever thing is done sectorally, from the different chapters, but eventually everything must be subsidiary to this thing. That one is really appreciated. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable McIntosh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it's great you have one of the telecom giants of the world giving evidence in this place, and I think we little realise what cell phones have done for the whole world in terms of development. Even relatively uneducated people can work a smartphone now. In fact, as somebody said, are you poor if you have a cell phone? and if you are still poor and you have a cell phone, then you aren't using your cell phone properly. So it's an interesting debate, but I think we should pay tribute to that and also recognize that the wonderful thing about the whole cell phone industry is it's all private. Apart from ICASA controlling and regulating, which is important, it's actually a tribute to free enterprise and what the energy of free enterprise can achieve in a society. So it's good to have Vodacom here. I think the what they have highlighted, and it's been highlighted by other people, is policy certainty. That's what the people are looking for. My colleague, Honourable Khadebe, has recognised that. We can't have BE from ICASA, BE from Water Affairs, and say, we'll give you a water use license, but then you must give so much percentage to equity to some community. Somebody else said, no, you only need 15%, and it's a nightmare for people. So I think that's important. I think the aspect of the commissioner is very interesting. I think, Madam Chair, we would be reluctant to start another Section 9 of the Constitution, like the Human Rights Commission or something. But I think the idea of a commissioner being appointed by Parliament within the DTI stable is certainly something which one can look at. Because as Gromit Khadebe says, having a good BEE policy applied and run by a good commissioner, or at least supervised by a good commissioner, is very important in achieving the national development goals. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable McIntosh. Honourable Mabaza.
Thanks, Corrie Chair. I wanted to find out that in terms of the skills area capacity building, what are the steps that Vodacom is taking, not only with regard to South Africa, but if we look at the continent, as well as if we look into SACU, how is Voda performing in that
area. Thanks.
Thank you very much. I want to re-emphasize the point to DTI. We hope that ICASA and the cell phone companies have indeed been consulted in this regard, the Department of Communication. And if not, then all speed should be dedicated to ensuring that if this is a current oversight, it should be immediately addressed effectively. And we won't ask more in that regard. The other issue is several of the submissions have spoken about there's been a trumping piece of legislation, an architectural sort of overarching sort of bill, and you seem to concur in that regard itself. And the other issue, though, which, I am a little concerned, you spoke about does the amendment pass the policy stability litmus test? No, on page whatever, 5. And you then spoke about implementation rules differing between the private and public sector. Now, that would be of concern to us as we are, through this piece of legislation, this amendment bill, trying to develop a synergy there to create a symbiotic relationship between the public and private sector to a very constructive result meaning transformation in its full meaning, not just the salt and pepper approach of some forms of empowerment. The other thing is how the issue should be addressed. Across the board we've spoken of alignment and so on, but there are particular issues that have been asked, and you may wish broadly to respond to them, but we would also wish that we can send certain other questions to you to respond in the first week of April or somewhere around there, so that the subcommittee chaired by the Honourable Khadebi, who will get into the detail, can unpack this even further. Thank you, sir, for your quick response here.
Well, Chairperson, thank you very much. As for the invitation to respond to some of your queries in writing, we are available to do that, and we'll do it in the shortest turnaround time possible. And feasible, will also participate in the subcommittee that has been created by this committee. Our question of skills development by Vodacom in South Africa and broadly across the continent, I'll ask Linda Martinez to deal with the question. And if Matthew, from an international perspective, you also have a view, you can come in.
Thanks a lot, Chair. In terms of skills, the one very good benefit of having a foreign parent is that you are able to actually bring very much needed skill that is only available at the moment, foreign-based, into the country. So one of the things that we have done, and we've introduced this since 2009-10, is that we assign a lot of black employees into the Vodafone companies for a 2-year period. Our CEO, our current one, is that very product, where he went into Spain and spent a 2-year period being skilled up in terms of how to actually run a multi-billion business. But we do this all the way through the entire business, all the way through different levels. The assignment is not just between us and Europe, but it's inter-Africa also. The Tanzania, DRC, Mozambique, all of those countries, there's that movement between employees there coming here and actually skilling us here, and then our employees moving there and making sure that critical transfer of very, very important skill is constantly happening.
Thank you. On the skills transfer question, just very quickly to add, we do as a company attach a huge amount of importance, as Linda has said, to enabling employees to grow themselves, and we see the ability to move people around the Vodafone family as a whole as a very important enabler of that. We do also have, looking at the wider economy, we have a number of projects running at the moment. Looking at Honourable McIntosh mentioned the very important role that mobile communications is playing in economies and societies. We do have a number of projects running at the moment looking at how mobile communications can enable literacy programs and broader education programs. And I think this will be an area of significant growth over the next few years. Our model is to develop these in one country, get them working properly in one country, and then spread them around. An example of that which has recently come to South Africa is the hugely successful money transfer system we have in M-Pesa, which started in Kenya, now in South Africa, in Tanzania, in a number of other countries. I wanted also, Madam Chair, just to address your comment about clarity and policy certainty. Look out from outside South Africa. Of course, there is a body of legislation which governs the telecommunications industry. There is a regulator which governs the telecommunications industry. That's what we would expect. And we would expect them to be taking decisions which enable the telecommunications industry to invest and to move forward. Given the importance of broad-based black economic empowerment in the South African economy as a whole, we would also expect there to be, as there is, legislation and public authorities looking at that. The issue arises if the one is able to do the other, as it were, and if you haven't got one place you go to understand broad-based black economic empowerment, another place you go to understand telecommunications, if you want to do financial services, we'll go to another place to understand that, that's fine. But if you have one authority that's able to do things in another authority's area, then it's very hard for us to assess what it is we need to do to get a single, simple answer that we can explain to our shareholders as the reason why we are adopting the structures that we're adopting in South Africa. So if through this process of amendment of the BBBEE Act, it's possible to achieve that simplicity and clarity about the approach that companies investing in South Africa need to adopt towards broad-based black economic empowerment, I think that would be a significant enabler of investment. At the moment, the uncertainty, as Honourable Kadeba has said, does act as a bit of a barrier to investment. Certainty would certainly help. Thank you very much.
So one last issue for us to discuss, Chairperson, is the notion of a commission, and this is a division in DPI that manages BEE. Look, we have our views about it should be a DPI, but to the extent that there's a strong feeling in this committee that the commission would work better for the reason that have been outlined by Honourable Member Khadebe, we will go with that idea, and we will make our input in terms of how do we think that commission can work, can operate optimally, and in a way that will take BE forward. So on that note, I want to thank Chairperson and the Honourable Members for giving us an opportunity to share our thoughts with this committee, both from a perspective of Vodafone as an investor, as a foreign investor in South Africa, and perspective of Vodacom as a South African and Pan-African company. Thank you.
Right. We would like to thank both of you and the whole team here for being with us this morning. And as there were quite a few names that we had, I'll just get the full list before me. Vodacom itself. We had Mr. Matthew Kirk, Mr. Nkateko Nyoka, Ms. Linda Martinez, okay, and Ms. Impo Makuva. Sorry about that. Thank you very much for being here, and also for the presentation that you've given us. We will be coming back to you, though. Thank you. Members, there's just one or two little pieces of housekeeping. One is a more pleasant one. I thought I'd better let you know today. The DTI has invited members of the committee, that any, you know, those who can attend, to go to the launch of what is called the inaugural South African Premier Business Awards. It is on the 20th in the evening, 5:30, perhaps even 6:00. This will be made available to you. It's for you and a partner to attend and to fill in all the necessary requirements that can be available to you. It is on the 20th, Wednesday evening, in Johannesburg, Sandton, regrettably. You know, I thought by leaving it out, the natural assumption would be drawn as to where it would be. That is why I thought I should mention it now to those who can make it. But there was a rather earnest appeal that we try and go there, because it is to celebrate, recognize and honor South African enterprises and entrepreneurs which promote the spirit of success, innovation, quality and good business. And I think that those are very important qualities which we should recognize. The other thing is, on Tuesday, we will be here at 9:30. I'm not sure of the venue. You will get that. We will start off with the AG just giving us a prep for about 30 minutes on the strategic plans, the comments there, and preparation in order to deal with them. We have more strategic plans than anyone to get through, as we all are aware. And, of course, the DDI's one. Followed by the first consideration, as it were, on the IPAP, including the colloquium. And there may be just a brief input from CSIR on an issue about related to impact on manufacturing, etc., and food security, and that is in relation to the wastage in respect of energy, water, etc. So instead of just cutting back, looking after, avoiding the wastage at the same time and saving in that particular manner and contributing. So attending to the emissions as well as the commissions, and that would, you know, just make it more holistic, our colloquium. I do want to thank to what I call the core members here of the committee, Stalwart, Honourable McIntosh, our whip, Honourable Khadebe, and Honourable Mabasa. I know we've all got sites, but I do thank you for being here and waiting and staying the course. Thank you to all of you who came here, particularly DTI, who've been here for the whole course. Thank you very much, and everyone else. Thank you.